Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And sitting in front of me is my loyal sidekick and fellow film enthusiast, Gabe Haggard. Yo, Gabe, hop on the mic. Say hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And joining us today is yet another very special guest. In addition to being one of my oldest and dearest friends, she's also a renowned art conservationist intern. Say hi, Emma.
Hello. Good to be here.
And even though Emma is often busy cataloging paint strips and playing with solvents and blowing up labs, hey, it happens to the best of us, and just generally working to restore great works of art, she still finds time to, you know, make a few art masterpieces of her own. And the art on our website will hopefully be coming courtesy of Miss Emma Gerard.
Definitely.
Awesome.
Okay, so on today's show, we're going to get a little meta on you. We're going to talk about the podcast, specifically what our goals are for this, the FlixWise podcast. And we're going to answer the burning question on everyone's minds. Who the hell do these kids think they are? Then we're going to follow that up with a discussion of the number three movie on the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time list, Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story. Finally, we're going to end the show with a little note of positivity.
Now, I'm never going to even try to say that man's name during the podcast.
Just, yeah, be forewarned, that's the first and last time you're going to hear that name on this show.
It's a good film, though.
Yeah. So let's get to it. Without further ado, I know in the past we've opened the show with our latest Sight and Sound entry, but I wanted to change things up a bit today because I'm crazy like that. But I want to talk about some of our expectations and goals in doing this podcast. Obviously, our main goal is to become super rich and famous. Right, Gabe?
Hear, hear.
And everybody knows the easiest and fastest way to get super rich is to give stuff away for free on the internet. But apart from being a get-rich-quick scheme, there are also a few other reasons I wanted to put together this podcast. I've always been a movie lover. For as long as I can remember, watching movies has always been my activity of choice. So, okay, you say, a lot of people really like movies. What makes your voice worth listening to? Who are you to think you could possibly have anything of interest to add to this discussion? Well, calm down, because I'm going to tell you. I totally went to film school. All right, next topic. No, not really. The truth is, Roger Ebert's death has left a big gaping hole in the critical community, and I think we're the ones to fill that void, don't you, Gabe?
I mean, it's a humbling thing to realize, but I really feel that the public is missing out on a lot. And it's really a service we can render the community at large and really humanity. So I agree with you.
But seriously, though, Gabe, these are the greatest films of all time. And we are... Gabe, why are we doing this? And also, why are our hypothetical guests so mean to us?
You mean hypothetically?
Hypothetical listeners. Why are they so mean?
Oh, well, I don't know. I think that we need to approach them through the guise of charity. You know, we can't impose our own understanding of their listening habits. You can lead a horse to water. You can't force it to drink. And you can teach a man to fish, or you can give him a fish. I'm not sure how the two are related, but...
Or how this relates to this discussion at all.
I want to do the podcast just because I really enjoy films, and I really enjoy talking about films and having quote-unquote serious discussions about film and about the art of filmmaking. And so I really don't have any highfalutin reason as to why people should listen to us, but I don't feel like we have to make any excuses about it. We just enjoy talking about films and are interested in sharing that with the World Wide Web.
Fair enough. That's as good a reason as any, right? Emma, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I'm never particularly interested in what critics have to say about movies. I don't have super highbrow taste, so I do love movies like the one we're going to discuss today and a lot of the movies on the list. And I'm always interested in what people who aren't professional film critics think about movies, and I think that's what you guys have to offer. You don't have to pretend that you're going to like all these movies, and you can bring your experience to it, and maybe people will realize that they can watch these movies and they don't have to get it, and they can enjoy them personally like you guys do.
So I specifically chose the Sight and Sound list because I feel like I have a pretty good handle on the American canon. Citizen Kane, Casablanca, you know, I get it. But a lot of the time, the movies on, like, the Sight and Sound list, it's a lot of international movies, a lot of black and white movies. Yeah, movies from all over the world. And in my experience, there are people who are interested and open to watching foreign films and people who are interested and willing to watch black and white movies. Though if you're not interested in watching black and white movies, you should just leave. I'm just kidding. Please stay. But I feel like we can be sort of a guide through, like, canonical cinema. You know, this list, it can feel a little foreboding, a little intimidating. But if people like us can go through it and maybe appreciate some and maybe not so much others, you know? So that was sort of my hope in doing this podcast. Gabe, how do you feel about this list? What comes to mind when you look at all these movies?
I mean, I think you touched on it. A large portion of these films I have not seen. And it's just, you know, a way of, you know, broadening my horizons and to see more films aside from just, you know, the American fare that I kind of predominantly grew up with. Just give me an opportunity to, you know, think outside the box and see what the rest of the world has been up to.
So, yeah, I want this to be like a kind of kiddie pool for budding film snobs. You know, like, come with us. We're going to get your toes wet. It's not going to be too scary unless we're watching Solo. But we won't. We're going to skip that one.
It's a little scary. No, it doesn't have to be scary. Like, watching films is definitely an enjoyable process. I think, like, if people feel shut out of it because they don't feel like they're watching them in a way that they're supposed to, that's, you know, that's not necessary.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think people are so hesitant to watch some of these movies?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the format of this show, too. A lot of those 100 lists, they either just are the names or they have little blurbs where a critic has, like, a concise statement about why it's such a great movie. Yeah. And they don't say things like, I really like the part where the kids fly a kite with their grandma.
Yeah. That was a really good scene. Yeah. We'll get to that. Yeah, I think that's true. You don't really get much from just reading the list besides, like, a little guilt knowing that you haven't seen all these movies and you probably never will. And so I think it can be really intimidating. Also, I feel like there's a sense that watching these movies feels like homework, and somehow, like, the film community, the film criticism community has bestowed certain honors upon particular films, and, you know, you feel sort of obligated to watch them, as opposed to really wanting to watch them. But that being said, you know, it's like in high school where they force you to read Huckleberry Finn, and you probably didn't enjoy it, and you probably didn't enjoy writing that 5 or 10-page paper. If you went to public school, probably 3-page paper. But it turns out, like, once you actually read it or if you revisit it, you know, Mark Twain was a cool dude. Huckleberry Finn is a good book, and it was probably worth reading.
I would say definitely worth reading.
Give it a shot. You know, and same goes for, you know, The Grand Illusion. That's a really good movie. Same goes for Tokyo Story, you know. It may be they're a little different than American films, but, you know, they have a whole lot to offer.
Well, in a way, I would like to sort of make an apology for people that don't watch these films.
Okay.
And kind of like we touched on, many of these films are so different than what people are used to. So it doesn't really come up. You know, like you said, the only time that you come in contact with these films is, you know, whenever you see, oh, a new list has been released of the top so and such and such movies of all time, and you just see all these names that, you know, you'll never think about and never look at again. What I think is sort of the charm of doing a podcast like this is actually taking the time to go through it, because a lot of these films can be extremely enjoyable. And so if you if you would just give them a chance, you know, and it can be really enjoyable to go through a list like this.
Yeah. Well, here's hoping. Yeah. And I think to a certain extent, I think a lot of these films that are on the list, I think maybe some of them are too high on the list. And I think we are going to bring a more skeptical eye just because, you know, we don't really know what we're doing. That's a lie. We totally do. But sort of an unbiased eye, or maybe less biased eye. I mean, maybe what you've long suspected is true, that a lot of these films aren't as good as people say. And I think we are not going to be afraid to tell it like it is. We have watched a lot of movies. We've watched every movie that we're going to talk about. We didn't just look on IMDb. I can promise you that. And we want to talk about movies, and hopefully you guys will dig what we have to say.
Well, that's another thing, too, I wanted to mention, is that in approaching this, I've decidedly avoided IMDb or Wikipedia or anything like that. And I know it sounds really pretentious, but I'm like, well, that's part of the enjoyment of doing the podcast for me, is just trying to think of my own ideas about these films. And as we go through the podcast, have different guests on, it's really fun to hear what somebody else thought about it. And to have like a quote-unquote more genuine discussion about these. It's not what somebody else has told me, what some other, as you alluded to, some other professional has told me about these films. It's what I have gotten out of these films. Oftentimes it's very little, but it's what I have gotten out of these films, and then sharing that with somebody else who has also gotten something out of the films. And then we can come together and talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think maybe we will observe things that, you know, they might not mention in a critical paper. You know, for instance, on last week's program, I think we devoted a good amount of time to Kim Novak's eyebrows in Vertigo. So the hard-hitting stuff.
And our guest hadn't even noticed.
Exactly.
They were a train wreck. All right, no, let's not. We could slip back into that and just listen to our last week's podcast.
Yeah. Emma, any thoughts, final thoughts on this topic?
I also wanted to say I'm interested to watch you guys finish this project. This seems like an interesting endurance contest. I mean, if you watch all 250 movies, you're going to be doing this for 5 years.
I know. By the time we're done, they'll have come out with a new list. So, and then we're going to have to start all over again. There'll be a whole new list of greatest movies.
Yes, I'm very excited.
Yes.
Maybe we'll have you on again in 5 years.
Great.
When we complete. But haven't we said that to all of our guests? That we're going to have them on?
You're coming back on again. Sorry.
No, but it's okay, you know, it's a reunion of like all of our guests are going to be on the inaugural podcast. It's going to be a party.
We are already planning our finish. But all right, that's enough navel-gazing for one show. On to the next topic. Now it's time for the segment we've dubbed, And You Call Yourself a Film Snob, where we go through the entire sight and sound greatest films of all time. This week's movie is Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story from 1953. Just to forewarn you, this is the first of many pronunciations that I will totally butcher. And just a heads up, we will be discussing major plot points, so I'm going to go ahead and issue a spoiler warning, though I think this movie is pretty unspoilable. But let me give you a brief overview.
I don't know if that's a word, unspoilable.
It totally is. Okay, quiet, Gabe. Let me give you a brief overview. This film is set in mid-20th century Japan. It's about an elderly couple that live a quiet, contented life in a small Japanese village. At the beginning of the film, they are eagerly anticipating their upcoming trip to Tokyo, where they will visit with their two eldest children. However, when they arrive, they are greeted with indifference, mild irritation, and bratty grandchildren. During their stay, their kids try to pawn them off onto whoever is willing to take them. They send them to their dead brother's widow, they buy them a hotel room at an age-inappropriate spa, they have them stay with old friends, anything to avoid spending time with their parents. The parents, sensing their children's disinterest, decide to head back home early. Now here's where the film gets really sad. In case you weren't depressed enough, it turns out that the stress from traveling was too much for the elderly woman to bear, and she ends up falling into a coma. Her children, upon hearing the news, obligatorily make their way back to their hometown in time for her death. They attend the funeral and make their peace with the loss of their mother. The final act involves the now widowed patriarch of the family anticipating the loneliness that awaits him as his children make their way back to their own lives. Just quickly want to point out that this is our first foreign language film on the list, and as such, I was convinced that this would be our first podcast without a guest, but fortunately, Emma stepped in just in the nick of time. Just a little background on my relationship with Emma. We've known each other since elementary school, and Emma was one of my best friends in high school, and she was someone who introduced me to a lot of the movies on this list. Were it not for Emma, I probably wouldn't be doing this today.
I love you too.
Aww. And so when I mentioned that I was doing this and that the movie was Tokyo Story, and I just asked Emma if she'd be interested, A, in watching it, and then in being a guest on the podcast, she said, yeah, that's one of my favorite Ozu movies. I've seen it like 5 times. So thank you so much for being here, Emma. Looking You're forward welcome. To your input. So without further ado, what did you guys think of this movie? Gabe?
I really enjoyed it. I think it's a really good film. And it's depressing and sad, but it's extremely well done and a really, really powerful film.
Emma?
I don't know if it's as depressing as you all are saying it is. I think there's a good balance of, like, joy and humor, but also sad things that happen in it.
Yeah, maybe it's not fair to say it's depressing. I didn't leave the film feeling particularly depressed. I thought it was sad, but certainly it's not life-affirming.
I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
Okay. Gabe, would you say it's life-affirming?
What do you mean exactly by life-affirming?
Like, I don't think it views existence as something that's necessarily positive. Like, life, it seems sort of, there's like a lot of existential unhappiness.
And,
you know?
I think that's maybe sort of what I meant by depressing, is that it doesn't seem to take all that positive a view of not life in general, but of kind of what is going on even within the film. It just sort of lacks an appreciation for life, and which I felt to be, you know, a little on the depressing side.
I kind of disagree with that. I mean, it doesn't have, like, a lot of Western movies will have a sort of, like, triumph of the human spirit or the joy and love of family. Everything will, like, come together and be wrapped up at the end. But it gives you a lot of moments, like, those sort of still, like, I think they call them pillow shots in film school, where he just lets you have, like, a moment to think about what just happened, looking at a train going by or smokestacks in this, or, you know, clouds. Or I love the ones of shirts hanging. And there's a lot of moments to think about just life. I've also read Ozu didn't really believe in necessarily making his soundtrack match what the actions in the movies are doing. So there are moments where those cutaways feel like they are part of a different story. Mm-hmm. And it's like sort of a moment to relax on the drama that's happening and just reflect.
Yeah. I can't exactly at this point wrap my head around why I liked them so much. Maybe it was just like it felt like a respite to what was happening, or maybe it was just a moment to appreciate, you know, these are the surroundings, this is a moment in time, this is life, this is all a part of life. But okay, so let's jump into the story. What did you guys think of the adult children's treatment of their parents, Gabe?
Well, I felt like it was bad the way they treated their parents, and I felt like it kind of goes in a sense from bad to worse. But you know, in the beginning, the way they kind of start out treating the parents, I felt that I could empathize with it in the sense that they You know, especially with the eldest son. You know, they come, he's going to do something with them, and then he gets a call, you know, and he's a doctor, you know. So it all begins very innocently, in a way. And then I think progresses throughout the film into not so good.
I think one of the themes in the movie, too, is that, like, their neighbor at the beginning says they're so lucky that they can go visit their children. And sort of an idea that I get from the movie is that we don't always interact with our family the way we wish we could have, but ultimately at the end we have the time that we do have with them, and it's not always as long as we want it to be, but as its value is just that it exists.
That's a really good point, and I have a sort of different, similar outlook, I think, as far as the relationship with the parents goes. But to what extent do you think the movie feels like the parents have sort of reaped what they've sown, you know?
And that's a really interesting question. And I was kind of interested to hear what you have to say about that, what your thoughts are mm-hmm. on that.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't quite sure how to approach that or what material is in the film that make you kind of want to discuss that.
Are they too complacent? Are they too accepting of their children's bad behavior? If you feel like their children not behaving well, or if, I mean, I think especially the depiction of the grandchildren, I mean, it's not a flattering portrait of those two brats, let's face it. And they're sort of accepting of that, just as they're accepting of their children's neglect. Were their expectations of their children too low?
I'm wondering if you were thinking also about, like, depictions of alcoholism in the
right,
movie
exactly.
as well.
Yeah. I wanted to bring that up. So the depiction of the eldest daughter, Shiku, something like that, maybe. Do you think it was a caricature, or did you think it was sort of a balanced portrait?
You mean of...
Was she caricaturally evil or unfeeling?
I think we didn't like her because of her cheapness. I wonder if that's also something that a Japanese audience would appreciate, or if it would be funnier to them,
right.
or if it would seem worse to them. I mean, part of the fun of watching this movie to me is I'm not from mid-century and I'm not from Japan, so a lot of it is, like, sort of ethnographic to me.
Yeah.
But I can't necessarily, like, think about what my response is supposed to be. I just can watch it, and, I mean, I wouldn't want someone like that in my family.
Right. But... I mean, I think it's fair, even as Westerners, to have an emotional response. And, I mean, so the first time I saw this movie, I thought she seemed pretty awful, but I have, after watching it this time, I sort of just start to feel like maybe she had reason to be. It wasn't so much that she was evil as much as she was feeling resentful, because as Emma mentioned, that much was made of the father's past alcohol abuse, and the daughter Shiku, hopefully, mentions that, you know, he didn't stop drinking until the birth of the youngest daughter. And I know, were I in her position, well, I'd certainly be glad my father stopped drinking. I might feel resentful towards him and towards my mother for allowing it to happen. And I might feel resentful towards my younger sister for, you know, reaping the benefits of my father's reformation. So I wonder if you guys felt similarly.
I did. There's also, aside from the youngest daughter, there's also the son who's passed away, and
right.
he's thought of very ideally in the movie. They
Is
can't.
He though?
I mean, not perfectly, but he isn't there to be part of this visit to Tokyo where everything goes wrong. The only interaction he has is that his mother gets to sleep in his bed, and that's special to her. But I mean, that it could have been totally different if he'd been alive. It would have been like, oh my gosh, I have to share this bed in this cramped
right.
apartment that you live in.
It's true. But so I thought even it was interesting, even the way the mother talked about her dead son to her daughter-in-law, Noriko, something like that. She even then, she was feeling, she was apologizing for him, both in that he probably didn't treat his wife very well while he was alive, and for dying and leaving her alone. So it's remarkable that these parents don't seem to have a very high opinion of any of their children aside from the youngest. And even then, they don't express a lot of gratitude towards her either.
I am just sitting here getting more and more depressed by the minute. How do you guys think that this film was not depressing? These are horrible children, these horrible parents that don't expect enough out of their children. And
so, I mean, I'm sort of willing to give the kids a pass a little bit because I think it's inevitable. Not to the extent we see it in this movie, but I think everyone can kind of relate to the idea that, oh, the parents are in town, I have to disrupt my life and tend to people that I don't really know well. I might be tempted to pawn them off on someone else, you know?
Well, and where I think that, like I mentioned before, where I think that goes from bad to worse is sort of the scene between the eldest son and the eldest daughter when they hear of their mother's coma, and they decide to not leave until the night train. That, for me, was when it went from, okay, I understand what the situation is. Like, maybe they could have done a little more to spend time with their parents, you know. Well, he had that doctor appointment, blah, 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 you know. When it goes from that, in that one scene was very pivotal for me when it became like, okay, you know, this is bad. When, like you said, you could forgive them or understand where they're coming from, what they're going through. And then in that scene, I stopped giving them a pass when it ceased to be okay or understandable or, hey, everybody's different. When their actions became not detestable, but became bad for me.
No, I think you're right. It was that at that point where I really, where they sort of crossed a line. I don't know if I bought that element. That's where, like, it was sort of a bridge too far, where unless you're on really bad terms with your parents, I don't understand not immediately hopping on a train.
Well, and that's the thing, that, like, what I think the beginning of the film was sort of a setup to that. All those things you're talking about, whether or not you forgive them or don't forgive them, or whether or not the parents were asking for it, sort of set themselves up, had raised these children that would do that to them. And then at that point, they start, you know, really reaping what they sow. Mm-hmm. You know, really sort of you see the fruit of their loins, like, doing that to them.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think is sort of like almost like a cautionary tale in a way. It's like, don't raise bad children. You know, like, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and then it also makes you think, like, okay, maybe I need to go a little more out of my way for loved ones.
Yeah.
You know, because like you said, whether the experience is good or experience is bad, at the end of the day, it's the experience itself that can be beneficial to you. And so to go out of your way to spend the time, to do the things, because then when you die, maybe they'll come.
I still feel empathetic towards everybody when they do things that seem wrong in the movie, because it does a lot to show that they've been sort of, like, estranged from each other by how quickly their world has changed and by what a different world the grandparents come from and the grandchildren are growing up in.
Yeah, I wanted to actually talk about what role World War II plays in the movie, if any. Emma, do you have any thoughts?
I wasn't going to talk about that, but it could be, again, watching the movie ethnographically, but I couldn't stop, like, this was the first time I watched this movie thinking that I would have to say something about it afterwards, and I kept making all these notes about the way that people were sitting in different scenes, mm-hmm. and this sort of theme of, like, chairs as, like, a modern symbol. Like, there was this joke about how they were embarrassed by the mother's weight when she was younger, and she broke a chair. And then it cuts to, oh gosh, it cuts to a pillow scene about a chair to the grandson who was told earlier that he has to go find his own place to study, and he's sitting in his dad's office and he's swiveling around in his chair not wanting to do his homework because he's mad at them.
So what do you think that symbolizes?
I mean, it's not traditional, I think, for Japanese households to have chairs.
Yeah.
And the grandparents are often sitting next to each other on tatami, or after they are running out of places to stay with their children, they're like sitting outside and just sort of enjoying the air. And they always sit side by side, and people tend to sit across from each other in moments of conflict in the movie.
Okay. I want to talk about the relationship with the daughter-in-law, Noriko. Do we think she's too good to be true? Is she too angelic?
I feel like you could juxtapose her character to the eldest daughter's character in terms of wondering if she's too much.
Right.
In the sense that maybe we're attacking Ozu's filmmaking abilities. You know, because you can think of it, you know, saying like, as far as the way that he's developed these characters, you could ask, has he purposefully made them too much? Mm-hmm. You know, so he's made two extremes to sort of shed light on the virtue can be found in the mean. And so in that respect, I don't think you would necessarily want to tone her down too much unless you toned the eldest daughter down. And in a way, the opposition of their characters kind of makes his point or sets the scene for you better. So I wouldn't necessarily want to see them too much closer to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the sake of just illustrating the scene or the situation that Ozu was trying to present us with.
Noriko is meant to contrast with Shiku, but I also thought she gets along much better with her in-laws than their blood children. And I wondered if she sort of embodied more, you know, what we'd call old world or our equivalent of that generation. If she embodied their values more than their children?
I don't think so, because she was living on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept insisting that she was okay. And that was something that the parents couldn't even comprehend, coming from the old world, that a woman would be able to live on her own. And she was on her own, didn't necessarily have a lot, but had enough. So she almost, in a way, is showing the modern world in a way, and showing that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because she still has the, I guess you could say, still has a respect and appreciation for the old world, but also we can't forget that she didn't grow up with them, so she doesn't have any baggage that all the children have, so that, you know, it may be easier for her to be nice to them. But she is sort of showing them and showing us the modern world and that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of why they get along so well is that they both remind each other, like being around each other reminds them of when the sun was alive. I think maybe Noriko is not being completely selfless and entertaining them in that it's like having her old life back. She doesn't get to like entertain guests a lot. She doesn't have sake sitting around the apartment like a lot of people might have. And she says she misses having him around to take care of.
I wanted to briefly talk about how the movie was shot and how it differs from Hollywood films of the era. Gabe, was there anything in particular that you noticed?
I noticed how timeless it was shot, in the sense that a knock that a lot of people have against black and white films or against anything old is how, you know, well, how stilted or how like weird, how archaic the cinematography is, or is black and white. I can't hear them the way they talk. They're not speaking normally. And I loved the cinematography. It felt so modern in a way to me that it really felt like a film really well shot for any period of time.
Was it distracting for you? I mean, there are scenes where dialogue, it's not cut on an angle. It's like they're looking directly at you. They're not talking to you, but it's shot dead on. How did you feel about that?
It didn't disturb me too much, and I think that that's the sign of a great artist.
I feel like, as the Ozu geek in the room, I have to say that his early movies, or like his silent movies, were shot like Western movies. Like, they look like Charlie Chaplin. But what he was doing in these movies was he was placing the camera at about 3 feet off the ground, which is where your eye level would be if you were sitting in the house on the tatami mats. So a lot of, I think, the goal of the cinematography in the movie is to make it feel very intimate, which is why it isn't so shocking when it's cut to a straight-on close-up of somebody discussing. It's like you're in the room and they're talking to you.
Yeah.
It sort of draws you into the family drama. You aren't thinking, like, who are these people? I don't care about their bratty kids.
Right.
You're in the household.
Right. It does really draw you in. It was intimate, but it also felt a little confining sometimes. Did you guys have that sensation?
Oh, like claustrophobic?
Yeah, a little bit.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, I think in various scenes, they were obviously trying to get that point across. You know, they lived in, they go to Tokyo, they live in really small places, and they don't have a lot of room.
Also, maybe the family unit is sort of an inescapable force.
Right.
Like, your domestic life isn't necessarily something you choose.
Exactly. Yeah. So, finally, I just want to, is there any one scene that grabbed you, that really stood out to you?
I think it was for me, it was the two scenes, the scenes where the siblings decide to not go until the late train. And then the scene when all the siblings decide to leave, mm-hmm. Were the two scenes that really made me not despise them, but sort of pity them, mm-hmm. In the decisions that they had made to neglect their mother and father.
Mm-hmm. Emma.
I know we talked about it, but I really liked the bar scene, and I'm a sucker for bar scenes in general and the depiction of alcohol in movies. I can't think of a lot of old movies where there's a scene like that that seems sort of realistic about friends going to the bar and getting a little too drunk and talking about their problems. It's either, like, too condemning or it's a joke, and that one seemed like a sort of happy medium that was relatable.
I'm gonna have to think about that. Give me a minute. The scene that really stood out to me was when the grandmother goes outside with her grandson and he's picking grass, and she's, you know, quietly observing that, you know, maybe he'll be a doctor one day. You know, I don't know if I'll be here, but
I was struck in that scene. I mean, if you've ever spent any time with a child of that age, you know that they're never paying attention to anything. So, but I noticed this, and I don't know how much this was supposed to be playing into the greater theme of the entire film, that he is completely ignoring her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That he has his back to her, and he is completely ignoring her.
Yeah.
That's the younger grandchild, though. He's really young.
Yeah. That's true.
People who had, like, you know, were alive when their grandparents were alive, but they don't really remember them.
Yeah.
But that is a very beautiful scene. Yeah. And sort of like the nature of having a family is you have children and they have children and they have children and you don't get to see everybody, but it's part of being part of the circle of life. And she's aware of her mortality.
Right, right, yeah. I related to her in that that's probably how I would deal with my grandchild. You know, like, I'd probably just start talking, and I don't know, I have a hard time relating to small children or children in general. So I might just start going on about something and they can amuse themselves. And I thought it was pretty. It was party. This is the number 3 movie on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time list. Do we feel like it merits its position as one of the top 3 movies of all time?
Well, I imagine at some point I'm going to have to stop saying this.
You're going to cop out, aren't you?
Only because we've seen 3 of them, mm-hmm. and, you know, they're a lot not to say that we haven't seen any of the remaining films. I'm sure we've seen a number of them, but we've seen three of them, and how are we going to say what place they fall in? I will say this. I do feel that it's in its appropriate place of the three that we have seen.
Okay.
Whereas I might still think that Citizen Kane should be number one, Vertigo would be number two, and this would be number three of the films that we've seen.
Okay.
I feel like this is a story masterfully told. I do find it very depressing, mm-hmm. and I don't agree with it being a celebration of life or being an appropriate celebration of life, because I view life in a more joyful, more hopeful way.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that this is a story masterfully told. And that is one aspect that I definitely took away from it while watching it. I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, you just like really, really enjoy it. It's really, really fun or really enjoyable to watch it. So I definitely think that it's one of the greatest films of all time, in the sense that it's just really well done and a story really well told. And of the three films that we've seen so far, I think it's in the right place.
Okay. Emma?
I mean, I don't really know what the criteria are for these top lists. Is it like, does a movie have to be like universally relatable? Or, I mean, is it that the story is well told? Or, I don't know.
I'm not sure. I mean, like, I haven't read what their criteria might be. And so, obviously, I am just kind of bringing my own criteria to how I'm viewing this list.
Right. I mean, so we can play this game. Like, yes. Every single movie and every single position on this list is arbitrary. I mean, I guess it's not arbitrary in that they polled a bunch of people and they put it into a mathematical equation and this is what came out. But really, what makes, you know, Vertigo better than The Red Shoes or Casablanca or, you know, Ugetsu or whatever. But it's just a fun exercise. So we're talking, you know, quality of the story, how well is the story told, and influence on other filmmakers, I think, are the primary qualifications. So given those parameters, do you think it deserves to be in the top three movies of all time?
I think if you're talking in terms of influence, like, there's a lot of different reasons and for making a movie and a lot of strategies to do it. And this movie is very different than Vertigo and Citizen Kane in the way that it tells its story. I mean, the Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock way of telling stories kind of like turns into like Kubrick, and then that is like basically like every movie we see now that seems worth critical acclaim is in that style, where you have to look for unexplained clues in the background and you have to put pieces together, but this one just sort of presents feelings and characters and emotions and life in a more stripped down sort of way.
Yeah. I appreciate that the way the plaintive approach, the quiet meditation that this movie presents, and I'm going to cop out too and say it's impossible for me to say does it deserve to be number three, but I don't think it's an unworthy choice. We'll just say that. Okay, so this is the final segment of our show. We're going to talk about one piece of media, a culture that we enjoyed in the last week. Gay, why don't you start us off?
Okay, what I've been enjoying this week is Apple's new editing tool, Final Cut Pro X.
Nice.
And a lot of people are vilifying it. It's a completely new approach to editing, and Apple has, you know, totally gone off the deep end with this, and nobody likes it, and blah, blah, blah. But this, the way they released this and the changes that they made to it are just lockstep for Apple. When they came out with the Macintosh or the Apple II, and it was this really, really popular computer, the very next computer they came out with, the Macintosh, I believe, made the Apple II completely irrelevant. And so they've been doing that their entire existence as a company. And since they have more cash reserves than the U.S. government, I think they're doing okay. And so I've just been playing around with it in the most recent short film I produced. And it's been a lot of fun. And it's been a really cool tool. It remains to be seen whether or not it will, you know, take over as my go-to tool and whether or not start using it professionally. But I'm having a really good time playing with it and figuring it out.
All right. We got one. That makes one person who likes the new Final Cut X. So good for you, Gabe, going against the grain. Emma, how about you?
Well, I just moved back to LA this week, and one of the big things I missed, this might seem thematic, but there's really good Japanese food here, and I'm really happy to be close to my Asian market nearby. So I highly recommend Japanese potato chips and candy if you have access to those. If you don't live near an Asian supermarket, you can order them online, and it will definitely open up your palate and expand your taste world if you haven't experienced that already.
All right. Do you have specific names for anything?
You know, I can't read a lot of the labels. Just like they're very graphic, you know, sort of packaging on these. You can usually figure out the major candy categories seem to be like traditional flavors like green tea and brown sugar. Then soda flavored ones that often have a fizzy center, and also chewy milk candies, whereas potato chips tend to be either just sort of salty or spicy or fish flavored. But sometimes you'll see something cool on the package, like it'll be like a dancing garlic. So you'll know what it is.
Awesome. That is an excellent recommendation. I would like to second that. We do have really good Japanese food around here. So last time we did this segment, I went with Star Trek, the final episode specifically. But this time I'm going to go with a different kind of hologram. At LACMA, they're showing a James Turrell retrospective. And I went there this week, and it was amazing. So if you have a chance, go check out that exhibit. They're also showing an Alexander Calder retrospective. But I understand that potentially some of our listeners don't live in L.A., so I'm going to go ahead and just generally recommend checking out your local museum. I recently had a discussion with someone where they were complaining about how L.A. doesn't have good museums, and because they were spoiled by museums in London and Paris and New York. But I'm here to argue that no matter where you are, there is culture to seek out, and it is worth doing it. So that is what I'd like to recommend this week.
Speaking of museums, you know, I missed out on the opportunity to ride a camel at LACMA today, which they were offering to the first 200 visitors of their Silk Road show.
And we are so grateful you're here. I apologize. I will personally seek out an opportunity for you to ride a camel.
I appreciate that.
After six cats. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
And that's the way we frame it, Flixwise that is. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Emma, for opting to hang out with us instead of riding a camel. Yeah, hopefully it was almost as fun as writing a case.
I think it was more, it smelled better.
Make sure to tune in next time for our discussion of Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game. Have a good week, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Carriage return.